evening and hello, everyone. This is Behind the Mic Radio, and I am your host, Dawn. And tonight, our guest is a Grammy and Dove Award winner. He made his debut at the Metropolitan Opera at the young age of 23. Can you believe that? And has performed with Francis Ford Coppola and Luciano Pavarotti. He has shared the stage with numerous stars on stage, film, and television, and he most recently appeared in the blockbuster hit Lincoln. We welcome singer, writer, producer, director, Elijah Chester. Hello, Elijah.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for taking time away from your very busy schedule. I know you have been crazy busy lately, and you've got a lot of projects going on. So thank you for giving us some of your time. We really appreciate it as well.
Absolutely.
Well, I prefaced your intro the way I did because you've done so many awesome things throughout your career. And I want to start, you know, when at the very beginning, actually, when you were 10 years of age and you began performing professionally at that time. And that is when you made your Broadway debut alongside Broadway stars Jason Gray and Tita Rivera. And I want to know what first drew you to the entertainment business at such a young age?
Well, actually, it was a play in elementary school that did it. It was The Jungle Book. And back then they had piano lessons in elementary school, and I'm sure I had sort of an inkling that I really loved music and loved performing, and that was the first chance I had, you know, to audition for something, the fifth grade musical, and the part had already been given, the lead part had already been given to a young girl, and I guess after the chorus teacher heard me sing, I still remember her coming to me saying, I think I'm going to give it to you and put the other girl in a different part. And so that sort of started it right there. And then a couple of years later, in middle school, is when I auditioned for Pippin. It was actually a touring of the Broadway show with Jason Gray and Chita Rivera. They were touring. It was a Broadway tour. And so I put myself out there and got a part.
Oh, wow. Now, what was it like to perform on Broadway at such a tender age?
Well, like I said, it wasn't, you know, at that point in New York, it was a Broadway tour, but it was still the Broadway, you know, touring company from New York. But it was just really, it was surreal. You know, I don't have great memories of everything that's happened in my youth from childhood. I'm one of those people that don't remember a whole lot about, you know, my youth. But I do remember moments like that, just feeling like it was incredibly special. Something was happening that I knew would be once-in-a-lifetime kind of experiences. I mean, I'm 11 years old, 11 and a half, something like that, meeting the president of Actors Equity Union, standing in Chita Rivera's dressing room, this grand lady of Broadway. And at that time, I really didn't know probably who she was, but you know, maybe my parents said, I think she's pretty famous, you know, and to just be a part of a Broadway touring company, period. You know, just, I came to a show and heard it in the intermission for auditions, and I went and got a part, you know, a part in the ensemble. So it was really surreal. And then to be able to meet up with him in New York years later, meet up with Jason and sort of have a colleague friendship, and he was on Broadway for Snoopy and other things, and just was a really magical time and definitely cemented into me very early on. That's what I wanted to be, was a performer, and I never turned away from it ever since.
Well, and you know, as you look back on it now, I mean, back then you probably had no, I mean, you knew something was really, it was big, but looking back on it, I bet you're just like amazed at how that journey kind of took off for you and how it kind of took shape all at the same time. You know, and I've been following you for quite a number of years, namely because, you know, you're married to someone I went to high school with. And
right.
I remember back in the day when, you know, Dawn is just such a lovely person. And I remember back in the day when you guys got married. And I remember reading an article in our local newspaper about you being in New York and you were doing all these great things and you were this world-renowned opera singer, and I was thinking to myself, wow, this is so huge for Alamance County, you know, and because it was so much, it was so much larger than life. And the thing that I've always been the most impressed by is how grounded you have remained in spite of the places you've been and the things that you've done. And you and Don are just such a lovely couple. So I just wanted to share that with you because I really did at that time. I was so enamored by that because that things like this never happen to people in Alamance County. And to, for you to go away and do something great and be from here, that was just amazing to me. So, so kudos to you. Now, I want to know, you trained at the famous Juilliard School in New York City, and mm-hmm. and what was your specific training in when you were there?
Well, it was a unique program that had never been done before for opera singers, for up-and-coming career singers, and it wasn't the master's level of a career. They were truly treating you as though you had you were ready to step into a professional career, even though it was a master's degree. So it wasn't your typical music performance degree you might get in a master's where it's all about music. They really wanted the next generation of opera singers to be dynamic in many ways. So my training, which turned out to be so fortunate for me as an actor, I trained just as much in voice performance as I did as an actor. I trained the Meisner technique. I trained all the different fencing and stage combat and character development, as well as diction and languages and, you know, all the different vocal things that you'd have to do, and theory and composing. So it was really hard. It was a very, very hard few years at Juilliard, no doubt about it. But I came away not just studying music or singing, as you might normally do in a master's degree of vocal performance. It was truly an acting and voice degree, and it was extremely hard. I don't know if they're still doing it that way. They don't even call the program the same thing that they did when we were there.
Well, I think that's amazing because that's just kind of like another feather in your cap, if you will. And it's just amazing to me how, you know, as you evolved through the years, that was just kind of one of those things that led you to the next stage. And one of the things that you have done is you performed at the Metropolitan Opera. Now, how did mm-hmm. that come about for you?
Well, I got to New York to Juilliard from being at the Santa Fe Opera apprenticeship program, which was a whole other incredible story. And so I'm at Juilliard doing my thing, just trying to be the next artist to appear on the scene and studying. And I had an agent who had several slightly more well-known, of course, and more experienced singers on his roster, some tenors. And one of the tenors had been awarded an audition at the Metropolitan Opera for a brand new world premiere opera that was coming the following season. And oddly enough, that the guy just wasn't interested in opera. He was interested in concert music and oratorios and things like that. So he turned down the audition. So my agent called me, and I still remember I was in the kitchen of my apartment, and he said, "I know this is odd, but I have an audition for you at the Metropolitan Opera." And I was 20 years old at the time.
Wow.
And I just didn't know what to say. You know, I was just barely mm-hmm. a student at Juilliard. And, of course, I said, "Well, yeah, let's go for it. Whatever, let's try this." And that's basically how it happened. I went and auditioned for this production called The Ghost of Versailles, which was a huge, huge world premiere with every star you can imagine in the opera world at that time. And I garnered a small part in the ensemble and an understudy of a lead character. And it was a dream come true, and it just started right there. And when I debuted, because of the time frame, you know, I auditioned as a 20-year-old and debuted as a 21-year-old. And
wow.
To record on date, I think, you know, unofficially probably, but you could look on their website most likely and find it, the youngest tenor to ever debut at the Met.
Yes.
It's kind of cool.
And
you know, I don't mind saying that.
That sets you apart. I mean, you know, how many performers get to start, I mean, get to do something like that at 23 years old? I mean, that is huge. That's larger than life almost.
And, you know, in the opera, it's very unheard of. Yeah. In the opera,
oh,
it's
yeah.
very unheard of.
So, you know, you have that record that I'm sure you will always have, because that is, that's, like you say, very unheard of. Now, as a result, you went on to, you know, perform with people like Francis Ford Coppola and Luciano Pavarotti. Now, what in the world was it like to perform alongside those greats?
Well, being under the direction of Francis Ford Coppola was, again, something I didn't deserve, and I kept wondering as I'm sitting here now at 40 something, and wondering, will these really cool adventures ever stop for me? What did I ever do to deserve this kind of life? It's too crazy, because, again, I was just a baby, and I really didn't know what I had. You know, here I did. I won this international competition for Luciano Pavarotti and was awarded the chance to perform with him and be mentored by him. And the next thing I know, not only was I going to be doing that with him in a production, but guess who the director was going to be? Francis Ford Coppola, as in one of the most, you know, amazing, famous directors and movies that there are. It was very, very, I would say it was real peaceful in rehearsals for me. It just felt like this is where I'm supposed to be. I'm supposed to be around this kind of art and learning. I've always been a sponge, and so being in the room with those two, I probably never said very much, but I just sort of stared a lot, you know, just listened to everything and just watched professionals work together and see what it was like to be, you know, a seasoned professional, because I myself was not one at the time, and you know, desire to be somebody that somebody else might look up to someday. And Francis Ford Coppola was very generous. He was just a sweet Italian man who spoke to you, you know, calmly. Maybe that was because he was with Luciano, I don't know. Same with Luciano, he was very kind and very sweet always to me.
Well, you know, they are about as big as it gets in the world of opera. But, you know, even though you perform with them, is there someone you would love to perform with, either past or present, or work with in that realm that you maybe have not had that opportunity but would just love to?
I've thought about the possibilities of what would it be like to enter back into the opera world. But I'll tell you, having been away from it for several years, the artists have changed. And, again, what was been so special about my career, I performed with all of the top artists. I performed with Luciano and Marilyn Horn and Jesse Norman and Placido Domingo, all of the top conductors in the opera world. Jerry Hadley was a colleague and friend of mine before he passed away years ago. So you kind of go down the list of my generation of opera singers and you go, well, there's not really anyone missing. Renee Fleming I performed with, Deborah Voigt I performed with, and the list goes on and on. So really, I accomplished what I would wanted to perform with on the top 20 artists in the opera field, in my opinion. I don't know who the younger generation now would be. So, yeah, I actually was fortunate enough to perform with everyone that I would want to.
Oh, wow. And how many artists can actually say that? You know, that's great fortune there. Do you ever miss, being on the opera stage? Do you ever miss that? Would you love to go back and do it for old time's sake, since you've been away for a few years now?
I definitely miss that grand theater stage, because it's unlike plays, it's unlike musicals, and it's certainly unlike film, of course. It's unlike any other live theater. It is so grand and so unique and so just larger than life that you get swept up in it, no matter whether you're at Mobile Opera or San Francisco Opera or the Met or in Rome or in La Scala in Paris. It's all, the sets are big, the music is big, the personalities are big. The casts are large, the experience, the drama, what you're creating, what you're singing is always over the top and dramatic and large and big. And I miss being a part of that kind of excellence, for sure. I definitely miss being a part of it. The stress of singing the roles and the tenor and the voice, having to stay healthy 100% of your life, and never being able to go anywhere, never being able to deal with allergies, and you come home from rehearsal and you go in your home and you come home from performances, you don't do anything. I mean, you really, your instrument is your moneymaker, and it's mm-hmm. in your throat, and you have to be very, very careful. You can't talk a lot, so the life after the performance can be very stressful and very lonely, and very boring, actually. But mm-hmm. I do miss the artists. I mean, how could you not miss working with James Levine or Zubin Mehta, the highest of the highest art that you can possibly partner with? I definitely miss that kind of excellence.
Oh, yeah, I most definitely. Now, you have also done theater and performing in productions such as The Lead of Frank in The Notebook and other works such as Candide and Masterclass. Talk a little bit about your theater experience.
Well, actually, starting from an early age, did a lot of theater in local community theater and, of course, middle school and high school and college. Always been an actor, always felt sort of the same that several well-known actors have said before, that even if they're singers, they'll say, "I'm an actor first and a singer second." I basically say that I'm an actor in anything that I do, and whether I choose to sing that or to speak it, I'm still an actor. So I think the experiences I've had on stage just absolutely solidify your work in film or commercial or in anything else, because it roots you in how to create characters and develop stories. My experience with Candide in L.A. was phenomenal. All of the different plays that I've done over the years, very dramatic to the very funny, have just taught me how to take a character at the beginning of the evening and bring it full circle at the end, which you don't get in film. It's very sporadic in film. You can do the end of the film before you ever begin to film the beginning of the film, so it can be very disjointed in that industry, but being in a play, there's just nothing else like that connection with the audience as well.
Yeah, I imagine, unlike, being on the big screen, it's very intimate because you're it's kind of up close and personal, and the audience really gets, they get a real rare treat, unlike when they're sitting, watching a feature film. I think it's a lot more personalized, don't you?
Oh, for sure. I think folks still get a wonderful journey of a character in a film, and they sort of watch a character go through their specific journey in the film, and they enjoy that experience, but that is nothing like what it's like to be an actor and do that on set. It does not happen that way, so it's different than theater. And when you go to theater and you see the play or you see the musical, it is what it was in rehearsal. It's exactly what we prepared this piece that went from the beginning to the end. In film, it's, you have no idea what happens behind scene. You could wait 7 hours to do a 3-minute scene, and you do it 17 times in a row, and that's the end of the film. And then you wait 2 weeks and come back and do the beginning of the film. It's just very, very difficult, very, very different.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. And now I want to talk a little bit about your Grammy and Dove Award win, because you're a Grammy Award winner for your work on Susanna and a Dove Award winner for your work on Our Savior Emmanuel. So
yes.
What was it like for you to win two of the biggest awards in music? really?
not really feeling like you're worthy of it, not ready for it. It's not my time yet. How did this happen? In fact, I didn't even know that I had won either one of the awards until someone contacted me and said something. The Grammy was a unique, sad situation where I had been invited, to come to the Grammys and be awarded the Grammy, but it went to my wrong address in Europe. At the time, I was back and forth living in Paris and in the States, and it went to my old Paris address, got lost with agents, the letter, the invite, and then eventually the Grammy itself got lost in the mail for about three and a half, 4 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, I didn't know until a few days after the Grammys had happened, someone literally called me on the phone and said, "Congratulations, how awesome is that? I can't believe that you won a Grammy." And, you kind of do the, "What's wrong with you? What are you talking about?" sort of thing.
Wrong number.
Yeah, and then I did a few I'm sure I did a internet search or something at that time to find out what they were talking about. Sure enough, there's my name and there's the win, and just sort of surreal. Like, what just happened? How did I not know about this? Shouldn't you know that you're getting ready to be nominated for a Grammy?
It's
Shouldn't you know about that?
Sake.
Don't they normally tell you? And it took 3.5 years to find out what happened. But you know what? When the knock on the door came 3.5, 4 years later, and there was a UPS guy and a big square box, and you open it up, and there's the Grammy inside of it. It becomes real for you, and it's fine, even though I didn't get to go. But,
oh, I know.
And,
oh, wow.
And then the Dove Award
And there aren't many artists that can say they've won a Grammy and a Dove Award. That's, you know, that is so simultaneously huge, because there's a, you know, that is the award to win in music on either side. So there's another unique thing that you've accomplished, you know, that not many people have. Your life just seems like it plays like a movie reel or like a good novel, because the way it's unfolded, it seems very charmed, and all the right things have happened at all the right times, and it's just amazing the things that you've accomplished that have almost kind of like, you know, they've fallen into your lap, so to speak. You've worked very hard, but all these amazing things have happened. More than most, you know, most people can say that are in this industry can say, well, I've done some great things. I've, you know, had a great life. But at the end of the day, it's hard to say that a lot of people have accomplished as much as you have. That's what makes you so unique. And so we're going to move right from that, because I want to ask you before time runs out on us. You have starred in various film productions, and most recently in the big screen blockbuster Lincoln. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about your experience, and how did that all come about for you?
Well, Lincoln has become and will always be a very, I wouldn't say bittersweet, I would say sweet, bitter experience. And I'll tell you why that is. First of all, I auditioned for what's called a day player role way back when. And that's basically just a one-liner in a movie, in a feature film. Feature film can be an independent company of very little money, and of course it can be a motion picture movie of multi-millions of dollars. And I knew it was going to be a DreamWorks picture, and I knew I was excited about auditioning. And then when I got the call back, it was an incredible experience to audition for a major New York casting agent. And by that time, I knew it was going to be a Spielberg film. And then that was done. I didn't get the part. And then several, maybe a week before they were starting to shoot in Virginia, they had already set up the offices and everything, I get a call asking, can I be in Virginia the following day, quickly. I said, sure. We need you to come and have we need you to have a horse riding test. And I said, okay. So I was just thinking maybe they were sticking in me in an extra little small part of some kind, which it was. I got there and had my riding test, and apparently what had happened is the guy that it was between me and the other guy for this one-liner, he said he could ride a horse and he couldn't. I grew up in the country, so I could ride horses, and I showed him all the stuff that I could do with a horse. And the equestrian, the guy immediately, the trainer, called up the production office, said he's good to go, and they said, okay, have him come to the costume shop immediately. I went straight over there, got fitted. They said, all right, come back in 4 or 5 days, and your scene is going to be starting next week. So, you know, I'm, of course, excited. This is amazing. I get to do line. And, you know, the one line was, we shouldn't stop here, Mr. President. Come to find out, it was a scene where Mr. Lincoln is walking through the battlefield at Petersburg, and I'm his immediate escort. I'm his lieutenant that's in charge of watching over him. And he stops for a moment to look at a dead soldier, and I sort of saddle up next to him on my horse and say, you know, Mr. President, we shouldn't stop here. So I'm so excited. I'm going to be on the screen with Daniel Day-Lewis. I'm going to be on a horse in a battlefield. How much better is this all going to possibly get? And I get there, and I have my own trailer, which is right next to Daniel Day-Lewis' trailer, and it just keeps getting better and better. I'm getting limoed everywhere. I'm like, this is crazy. I have one little tiny line. What is this? This is just weird. You know, what did I do to deserve this? I got one line here, guys. Just put me in the tent. I'll be fine. And then we got all prepared that day for shooting, and they canceled it. Something happened with the weather. no problem. Then the next day I get a phone call from the production company that I'm being considered for a larger scene. They're sending sides to my hotel. So they give me the sides. I memorize them that night. The next day I'm in front of Kathleen Kennedy, one of the biggest producers in Hollywood. She's produced all of Steven Spielberg's movies, you know, real famous. And I have my interview with her, and basically she says to me at the end, all right, this is what I need for you to do, this, 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 and this. Can you handle that? And I said, ma'am, I have two daughters. One's a teenager. I'm sure I can handle that. You know, just sort of, I don't know why I said that, but I just sort of, it just blurted out, and she laughed and said, oh, good, you got it. And what had happened was they took away the one-liner and gave me a three-page dialogue scene with David Oyelowo at the end of the movie.
Oh, wow.
Huge scene. I mean, I can't tell you how wonderful this scene was. And long story short, we did all of that together, had a great time working together, David and Steven and all of us, the stuff. But what happened was the plot of that scene conflicted with the overall vision that Steven was trying to do with the film. So I was contacted by the writer and some of the production company that he was probably going to pull that scene from the overall final cut.
Not to be upset,
you know, not to come to the premiere and be upset that it wasn't there. So they sort of gave me a heads up so that I wouldn't be looking for that scene at the end of the movie and cry when it wasn't there. And so my big Steven Spielberg debut where I'm on screen, you can't miss that it's me and David Oyelowo going at it each other. But I know I was there and I have pictures to prove it and script to prove it and contracts. So that's why it's sort of bittersweet. It was an amazing experience, and I do not regret any moment of it. And I still ended up in some of the battle scenes in the background, riding next to Daniel Day-Lewis, and did get to work, of course, with Steven, and I was there for 2.5 weeks, so it was an unbelievable experience, to say the least.
Oh, you know so, and you never know what doors could open for you from this, you know. And do you have, like, video of that scene that you did?
I'm not allowed to have it. Yeah, I'm allowed to have it. Yeah. I'm sure that footage, it won't even go into the DVD, I'm told, because it's just one of those things where Hollywood, very often when they have the true Hollywood makers, they'll film things that might cost $75,000 and toss them in the trash. That's what I was told, that they have the ability to make that kind of decision and just let something go. And that includes footage. They'll destroy it. You know, they'll never use it. It won't be a part of any sort of director's cut. It won't even be on the director's cut because Steven didn't want it in the plot. The producers, Kathleen Kennedy, and the writer wanted it in the movie, but he didn't want it in the movie. So it will never go in the movie.
And, of course, you know, with it being Spielberg, that was going to supersede and veto all other, whatever anyone else wanted, I'm sure. So, you know, but I have yet to see the movie, and I really want to, you know, see it. And as a matter of fact, I'm a huge fan of Sally Field. A little backstory on her. She portrayed my late aunt in the movie Norma Rae. She actually portrayed my aunt. That movie is about my aunt. So I've always had mad respect for her and love her as an actress. Everything she's ever done, I've loved. So, she really did such a great job in that film. And I was so excited when I learned that she was being cast, you know, for Lincoln. And of course, you know, following you, I was like, he's going to get to see her, you know, and I'm so happy that was such a good experience for you, in spite of the fact that the very end, you know, it worked out like it did. But that is a memory, that a takeaway for you that, you know, no one can ever take away from you. It is yours forever, you know. And it's no telling what can happen for you from here, you know. And I'm sitting here as I'm listening to your story, I'm thinking to myself, if you ever write a biography, an autobiography, you can say, what did I ever do to deserve this, you know, to title it? I mean, that, because everything about your life is just, in a way, seems really surreal. I mean, all these magnificent things have happened to you. It's just incredible. There's one last thing I want to ask you about, and that is that one of the movies that you starred in was Find a Way, which is based on the life, as you know, of Harry Cohen. And for the listeners who may not know, Harry Cohen was a star quarterback of mine, and Elijah and I live in the same community, and he was a star quarterback at a local high school in our community. And He unexpectedly died after the biggest game of his career. And he broke all kinds of records that night. It was just incredible. And so Elijah was actually cast to be in the movie Find a Way. And I want to ask you, Elijah, how difficult was it for you to perform in this movie, given how close you were to Harry's family and to the story?
It was certainly difficult to, in a sense, take something that's so real in life, you know, a death of a dear friend, and I hate to say the word play at it, you know, mm-hmm. to recreate that as if I was the father. You know, it's a very odd thing to go away from a family member or a friend's funeral and then portray that event in a play or portray it in a film. So at first it felt, you know, am I doing the right thing? You know, is this right? Is it long enough yet? You know, he hasn't passed away mm-hmm. long enough. Do I feel right about sort of portraying these emotions? But I wasn't portraying them, of course.
Right.
There was nothing about those moments when the camera was rolling that was very hard at all to be emotional. You know, to see an actor representing Harry laying in front of me on a hospital bed, there was no quote unquote motivation or character development needed. It was just, this is a sad event, and I'm decided to just try my best to portray Richard, his stepdad, and my best friend from school, just to portray his love and personality on screen, to show his gentleness, and my coworker Jennifer to show Richard's wife and Harry's mother Jennifer as well, just to portray them as wonderful parents and be able to share this story of a kid whose life has still and will always influence others. So hopefully, you know, this movie is loosely based on it. It's a small part of the plot, but there are plans to make a full feature film that's completely about Harry Cohen, which is exciting to know that that's going to happen as well.
That is exciting. And, you know, there's another major coup for our community. And I really like the way that film, Cornelius did such a wonderful job with that film and writing it. And you know, in talking with him recently, you know, he was saying that initially, a lot of that film had already been written before, you know, Harry ever passed away. And so
it
was just kind of the perfect ending almost, the way it just fit into the original script. And it ended up being such a beautiful, moving thing for so many people. And like you say, he will always touch lives, even those that didn't know him or his family. It just had such an impact on so many. And, you know, I remembered it as it was yesterday almost. And I'm very, very happy that you were able to be in that. And I can't think of anyone else that should have portrayed his stepdad any more than you. So I was real excited when I saw that you've been cast to be in that role. And especially, you know, given what the story meant to you personally, as it did to
so
many of us. Now,
it was a way of memorizing, you know, for me to give a memorial to Harry as well.
Yeah,
it'll always be documented sort of as my little memorial to him, to little Harry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, I think the thing that was so unique about Harry's passing is that it made people really want to go out and do something, you know, if not surrounding his death, something for others, you know, in some way, shape, or form. And mm-hmm. I think that has been the thing, the legacy that he left behind for so many. And it's a beautiful thing, you know. I am excited to think that it's going to be, you know, a major film. But I think the world needs to see this film. And I think they need to see it on a grander scale than just in our community. So I really hope I will be keeping my fingers crossed and hoping and praying for the best on that.
Yeah,
and,
well, it's you know, has a star director. He just got a major role on Army Wives, Burgess Jenkins. So, you know, his excellence in directing and his crew, and with Cornelius is producing, it's worthy, like you said, of being not just a small independent film showing, you know, locally at a high school, but it should be across the nation showing in some other theaters.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly. Now, I have one last question for you.
Mm-hmm.
You have accomplished so much in your career. I mean, so many things. And what is something that stands out for you? What is your biggest accomplishment today? What is something that just stands out for you?
It's going to sound cliche, but it's not, because it's extremely tied to the choices that I've made in my career. But I would definitely say my family, the three women in my life, definitely guided the decision and have always guided my decisions as to which direction I would go in my career and how much, how I stay humble in the choices that I make and try to do the best that I can in the situation that I'm in. You know, I walked away from a major multi-international career for a family to make sure that my daughters would know me and my wife would know me, and we wouldn't end up being a terrible statistic. And so I'm proud of the family, for sure. I'm proud of that. Because all of the other things, the other memories, the accomplishments, the awards, the films, that stuff, certainly it's just a fading thing. And in the end, it doesn't matter if I had won every award you could win and had performed with every top artist that you could perform with, if I couldn't keep a marriage together, if I couldn't be a father that was true to my daughters and to prove to them what it means to be a man that stays and loves you. You know, those are the things that will last a legacy forever. Those are my proudest moments and accomplishments, and I'm certainly not there, but I'm trying.
Well, I bet if I asked Dawn, she would most definitely say she's got a keeper in you. So, I mean, I love, you know, seeing your social media comments, and you're just so cute as a couple. And, of course, I've always loved Dawn DePisa. She's one of my favorite people from my high school class, and your girls are beautiful. And, you know, and I think the fact that you chose family over career, I think you can never go wrong in that way, as you know. And your girl, you know, those three women in your life are your biggest cheerleaders, and they are, I see it often, you know, from her posts, just different things. I mean, they're very proud of you and what you do, as we all are. And you're just a phenomenal person, and I'm just so glad to at least know you in a small way. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. You are a true inspiration, and in spite of everything that you've done, I'm always inspired by you in that you stay grounded and you stay true to yourself. So thank you. Oh, and I can't let you go without asking you about this. You are in the process. You've got a project going on right now, and I think the listening audience needs to hear about this in case they want to, you know, kind of check it out. Talk about this theater project that you're working on.
Studio One, yes. Just recently joined the board of a local theater called Studio One. They have, over the years, been a local company that puts on kid plays and some adult plays and musicals and things like that, and have never really had a home until now. And we now have a sort of a gutted open building that it's just rigged right now to continue to put on plays and classes, and they're getting ready to do a big Scarlet Pimpernel in a couple of months. But we are in the midst of a much-needed building campaign to build the first theater in Alamance County since 1928. The Paramount, or the Grand Theater, which ended up becoming what's called the Paramount Theater here in Burlington, was built, showed movies and did all kinds of things, and then it was sort of let go and rebuilt in 1998. But currently, that is our only theater in this whole entire area. You have to go to Greensboro, High Point, Chapel Hill, those areas, to get to another official theater. There are, you know, there are school gymnasiums and theaters around here, but those are government-owned, and they're just not a theater. This will be the first one built in that many years, and it'll be a 120-seat, 115-seat black box thrust theater with full dressing rooms and rehearsal halls and a beautiful lobby. And we need money, so we're doing our 30-30 campaign. We're trying to get as many people we can to give $30. You know, that's 10 Starbucks drinks. And just raise the money necessary to build a theater, not just help us produce plays and just do the same old, but do something historic so that years and years from now, long after I'm gone, there'll be a theater that's here just like this one that was built in 1920s in Burlington.
That's
what I'm on.
I'm so, so proud of you for taking that on and for heading that up and trying to bring that to Alamance County, because, you know, I love the arts, and you can never have enough theater. I mean, the Paramount has done so phenomenally well over the last several years with the productions that they put on, and I've been to several, and it's just a class act. And so, that, you know, when I initially saw your info on that, I was just so elated to think that we are going to have something like that. And of course, if you're involved, it'll be second to none. I already know this. So.
Well, I'll tell you real quick. There's a girl just like myself, born and raised here, had no confidence in herself years ago. She really just did not like herself and was afraid to speak to people and do anything. And because of the performing arts, she is now a bubbly young lady that teaches in a school and gives back and volunteers. Same for me. I was this little bumpkin kid with parents who knew nothing about anything except, you know, fighting fires and working in an office. They're sweet parents, but they didn't know anything about the arts. And
mm-hmm.
because of the performing arts, I've seen the world. And
yeah.
I shouldn't have coming from a little place that I did, but because there was enough arts at the time to continue to grow me, and because I would use the arts, I was able to see the world and experience things that you don't normally experience. And I know there's going to be, and there are, young people and even older folks that need the arts for different reasons. They need it
mm-hmm.
so that they can feel better about themselves. Or some little 12-year-old or 10-year-old like me is waiting right now to have those foundations put in them so that someday they can say, you know, I'd like to thank my mom and dad standing in front of a podium at the Tony Awards or Grammy Awards and have that experience because of something that we could do here at Studio One to help them in Alamance County. So that's why we're doing it.
Well, thank you for all your contribution to the arts and everything that you have done to make us in Alamance County very proud of one of our own. So thank you very much. And with that, I want to thank you also for being with us this evening. It's been a real pleasure having you here.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and give my best to Dawn and your family. And I'd love to have you back later on as the progress of this unfolds, because I know it's going to, and maybe talk about your first production, major production, once it's a finished product, and let the listeners know all about it.
That sounds great. You bet.
All right. Thank you, Elijah, and take care of yourself, and we'll talk to
take
you again
care.
Real soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Ah, he is such a nice, nice person, and I've known Elijah for a long time, and his wife Dawn, and their lovely girls are just a beautiful family, and he is true inspiration. I mean, he is someone who has been all over the world. He's done a little bit of everything, as you heard in our interview, and he still remains so grounded through it all, and he's back, you know, home where he began giving back to the place where he was from, and I think that is awesome. And so that is going to wrap our interview for tonight. And if you would like to touch base with Elijah, he does not have a Twitter account, but you can find him at Elijah, E-L-I-J-A-H, Chester, Chester.com. And that's his website. But he has Facebook, and you can go there, and it's Elijah.Chester. And he has a full-scale blueprint of the Studio One project he was just speaking about. And the theater is going to be called the Sarah McMillan Brown Theater. And he has information there, you know, that tells you how you can donate and if you'd like to give to that. So I want to thank everyone for being here tonight. And if you're brand new to our program, welcome aboard. We are so glad to have you, and we hope that it will not be your last time with us. And we look forward to many, many more times here with you. So with that, I will say good night. Enjoy the rest of your evening, and we'll be right back here again real soon. Take care, all, and good night.
One taste of Main Street Cake Shop, baked from scratch, custom-made cakes and cupcakes, and you'll be hooked. Every cake is made to order with only the finest and freshest ingredients. This is no ordinary bakery. Cakes are never pre-made. Main Street Cake Shop is in demand, having provided cakes and cupcakes for numerous prestigious events, bridal fairs, and venues. Owned and operated by April Murray, she has garnered many awards for not only her exquisite cake designs, but also for their incredible taste. If you're looking for a cake for any occasion, or cupcakes in a variety of flavors, then Main Street Cake Shop is the place. Visit them on the web at mainstreetcakeshop.com.